So is there anything you'd like to talk about or bring up, or something left over from this morning, or thoughts you had over lunchtime? Did everybody have a pleasant lunch, I hope? Yeah. So anything?
I love your, what you said about metaphor. And spent quite a few years in the Zen tradition, and 20 years ago it would have been frowned upon to even use that word, I think.
Oh, really?
Very much everything is just what it is.
Right.
It would have been seen as a thinking overlay. So I'm very curious your thoughts on that.
Well, you all heard that. She's saying that years ago when she studied Zen, it would have been, the idea was that metaphor was somehow a thinking overlay, separating you from things as they are, pretty much. Well, I think with all due respect to everybody concerned, it seems like a pretty simple-minded way of looking at things, you know? Yeah. Yeah, right. So, I mean, early presentations of Zen sounded like that. They sounded like they were saying, the whole problem is thinking. That's the problem. If only you could stop thinking and just be directly in connection with reality, then everything would be fine and you would be, that would be Zen enlightenment, and the enlightened Zen people have all this figured out, and what's wrong with you? That was basically the message. And then, so then you listen to that and you maybe you believe that, but then you couldn't help but notice that, try as you might, there was occasional thinking going on in your life. And so now, you had now become your own worst enemy, because you were a human being, you thought you weren't supposed to be thinking, it was anti-Zen to be thinking, and so this was all a mess, and you either struggled along with this problem and feeling badly about yourself for 20, 30 years, or you went on to other things, always secretly believing that they were right and that whatever else you were doing wasn't quite it. So this is a pretty sad state of affairs, isn't it? And if you think of Zen practice or Buddhism as religion, this sounds like bad religion to me, don't you think? It sounds like what a lot of people would complain about Christianity for, a similar, in fact, almost the same thing. You're a sinner. You're not supposed to be sinning. But every time you look, you can't help but notice that you're sinning. So you're in trouble. And you either suffer along with this, feeling guilty for the rest of your life, or you abandon it, give it up, and move on to other things, secretly believing the whole time that they were right. This is almost the same story, right? And whether or not the Zen teachers intended to be giving us that message and giving us that story, who knows? But that is the story that we got. So I don't think it's really right, personally. But then again, you know, what do I know? I mean, I can't claim to be a Zen master, or like, just listen to me and I'll tell you what Zen really is. All I know is what my life is and what I'm, you know, that's all I know. So all I can vouch for is my own experience. So if somebody thinks that this is entirely wrong, it could be. I don't say it's not. I'm just saying this is my life and this is the way I understand things. Now, in the early 1970s, I was a Zen student, and also studying religion in the university, getting a master's degree in religion. And I did my thesis on Zen Master, on the writings of Zen Master Dogen, which I've been studying, started studying in the late 60s and have been studying ever since. So a lot of what I, my point of view on the Zen tradition comes from Dogen. And a lot, the Dogen is a very particular take on Zen practice. Dogen actually writes very directly about this issue of thinking and metaphor and language. And so that's where, how, what's shaped my views is my study of Dogen and my contemplation of Dogen over my entire adult life. And here's what I get out of it. Here's what I think. Here's how I understand what Dogen is telling us. First of all, Dogen is really critical of Zen teachers. Some of his most vituperative, nasty writing is reserved for Zen teachers who say what you said. Not that you said it, but you know, that message. Thinking is the enemy. Language is the enemy. Cut off your head and you'll be enlightened. He has a lot of, he really thinks that that's a problem for all the reasons that we know it's a problem. And his point of view is that, and again, this is my reading of Dogen, my interpretation. I could be entirely wrong. Somebody else could have a different interpretation. But what I get out of it is that we're human beings. Being human is inevitably thinking. It's a part of being human. Being human is inevitably being languaging creatures. We're inevitably creatures of language. Definitely. We all know, we all could attest that there's a lot of problems with thinking in language. We can really mess ourselves up with the way we think about our lives and the way we describe our lives to ourselves. So it's not as if this is not without problems, and there are major problems, and that's part of what we're doing in our spiritual practice, is trying to see through our self-deceptions, our self-destructiveness, our self-hating or self-denigrating descriptions and so on of ourselves, that we know that. But the idea is not that we should eliminate thinking and language, but rather that we should dwell within thinking and language in awakening. So that so we can have a moment of perception that seems to be very pure, and so much of Japanese arts and literature are about the privileging of that experience. But as soon as you express that experience, as soon as you think you had an experience, it's already being incorporated into language and identity and so on. And Dogen is saying, we have to know that that's part of our lives, and we have to be wise within that process and see through that process so that it doesn't become a process of suffering, but becomes a process of communication and mutual awakening. So one of his main points is that there is no such thing as an experience that isn't also a moment of communication, a moment of connection. We're always together, and our being together happens through our interaction of communication, thought, and interaction with one another. So it's not a matter of going beyond thinking, outside of thinking, or transcending thinking. It's a matter of being awakened within the process of thinking, being awakened about thinking, being awakened about language. So the practice remains intact. Dogen is not arguing with the practice. He's just saying, in effect, he's saying, Zen practice, and I think he means, for Dogen, Zen isn't Zen, it's just Buddhism. It's just the Buddha way. Buddhist practice, and I would even make that broader and say spiritual practice, it's a religious life, it's a whole life. It's not a special technique to sort of somehow zap us beyond thinking and put us in some sort of special technical zone. You know, bing, all of a sudden now we only hear the sound of the bird and that's it, you know. I mean, yes, we have those wonderful moments. It's not that those moments don't occur and that they aren't important and wonderful. But they're part of a whole religious life, a whole point of view, a whole life of practice and cultivation. And to some extent, depending on our circumstances and our interest, an intellectual understanding of the teachings. It's a whole life, like any religion is, right? I mean, I think religion has, it has faith, it has ethics. You know, it's a life. And it's not that it's not experiential. Of course it's experiential. But show me somebody's life that's not experiential. Life is experiential, right? Isn't that what life is? It's having experiences. And the question is, what kind of experiences are we having? And how do we understand them? And how do we go forward living based on the experiences that we're having and how we understand them? So, there's been, you know, a lot of scholarship also done in recent years. There's a whole wonderful new crop of religious scholars who are studying Buddhism and studying the phenomenon of religion, who are pointing out to us the incredible nest of misconceptions that was attendant upon the first wave of Buddhist practice and teaching that came to us in the West. And it was all understandable. There's no bad guys here. It's, you know, we had a cultural context at the time and we understood everything in that cultural context. Now it's 40 years later and maybe we understand better what's going on and what has happened in the past. So, so those early presentations of Zen had their beauty and their charm, and I don't mean to say that they're all wrong and we should, you know, denigrate them. But there's so much more. It's so much more rich than that. That was just one piece, and I think that was the piece of it that was most attractive to us and got our attention because it was so foreign to us. It's just a much fuller and richer picture than that. So certainly in my practice and the way that I work with people, I'm by no means telling people you shouldn't have emotions, you shouldn't have thinking, you know, you shouldn't have language, you shouldn't read anything, I'm not saying that to people. I'm saying we have to be intelligent human beings in our lives, in our cultures. We have to have a religious life, an inner life, a spiritual life. We have to cultivate our practice and we have to work on it. I mean, I'm a great advocate of sitting every day, not just in retreats, but every day, and bringing the mind of sitting to our conduct, to everything we say and do with one another every day, and seeing what our life is. But it's an ongoing cultivation that involves everything in our lives. It's not eliminating something in our lives. Also, I think the whole proposition of transmission of religious culture across social and historical and linguistic barriers is also something here. In other words, our culture is not an Asian culture. Our culture is a culture that's in dialogue with an Asian culture, and it's changing because of that dialogue, and we're changing because of that dialogue, but it's a dialogue. It's not like all of a sudden we're going to like do surgery and like remove our Western mind and plop in, you know, a Japanese mind or a Tibetan mind or something like that. No, we're going to have to take our mind as it is and our conditioning as it is and little by little reflect on it and have it change in dialogue with our practice and with what we're learning from Buddhism. So in a way, the Buddhism that we're practicing is of necessity, somewhat different from Asian understandings. And in the beginning, maybe we were trying to imitate or think we could receive an Asian understanding as if that was even possible. So, yeah, but I think most people, when they hear about Zen or Buddhism, we have a whole set of cultural presuppositions that are probably all wrong. That's how we hear these things, and it takes a while to sort of say, well, what's really going on? To see what's really going on. Yes?
Who are some of the scholars that you're referring to now, in a way?
I'm smiling because I just got a wonderful phone call last night. Joe and I were in the car, and there's two scholars that are very good friends of mine. One is named Hal Roth. He teaches in the Religious Studies Department at Brown University. Anybody here a student of Hal Roth? No. Sometimes I run into people who practice Zen because they went through Hal's classes at...
I know from the
So yeah. He's a student there, has been for many years. His classes have labs. He gives a class in religion with a lab. And the labs are all meditation sessions. They go to have a lab. Anyway, there's him, and then there's a wonderful guy at University of California, Berkeley, named Bob Scharf. He's another one, but there's a whole bunch of them. But the reason I'm mentioning those two is because last night when we were driving home, I got a phone call from Hal. I haven't talked to him in a long time, and I don't know. This nothing else to do. I'll tell you the story. So. Can I make this brief? So Bob wrote to me one of the most brilliant essays on religion I've ever read, in which it's a long story and I'll just make it short, in which he debunks the idea of religious experience. But he does it's not what it sounds like. It's a very powerful and important essay that he wrote. So I really believe that he's right about this, and I've thought about it a lot and talked to him a lot about it a lot, and I've shared this essay with many of my friends. And his point essentially is not that there's no religious experience, but that the accumulation of experiences for their own sake, as if that's religion, to have some experience, and that's what religion is about, is reducing something very rich and complex to something very small. It's kind of like the conversation we were just having a moment ago about Zen, right? Do you understand? So he wrote this article. Well, this makes smoke come out of Hal's ears. He hates this article. He hates this idea. He thinks that Bob is denigrating religious experience. Hal is a very serious Zen student, and he hates this idea. So he's been mad at Bob for 20 years. So I go to see Hal, and I say, Hal, you know, I really think you're misunderstanding this article. I don't think you really, Bob doesn't really mean it that way. And Hal said, rah, 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 rah. He doesn't agree with me. He's complaining. And I said, okay. So the reason Hal called me up last night is because he happened to be at a conference with Bob, an academic conference. And so I know them both really well, and so there's this kind of triangle, you know, and so Hal and Bob had a conversation about this article, and Hal saw the light about the article. He said, oh, you're not saying what I thought you were saying. You're not saying, I see what you're saying. And he called me up to tell me this. He called me up to tell me, he said, I'm here in where are they? Colorado, I think. I'm here in Colorado with Bob, and I haven't seen Bob in all these years, and I've been mad at him in all these years, and we finally sat down and talked about this article, and we talked about our mutual conversations with you about it, now I get it. I said, I'm so happy now. That's great. So great. But there's many other really brilliant scholars, and it's very exciting, actually. The religious studies departments in universities are very lively. Lots of young people are interested in this subject, and they need to be. I think religion is really important now. And the kinds of scholarship that's going on is very interesting and very, it's really deeply thought through. Deeply thought through. It's very different from those of you who are around my age, who maybe studied these things at university a long time ago. It's a totally different point of view now. So I read it to a certain extent. As I can, this scholarship, and it's provided. We have to get. I mean, we're coming into a period of time on our planet where religion, we really need religion. We need comfort. We need compassion. We need a tremendous sense of patience and vision about what our future is going to be. We've got to be able to work with our fear and our confusion, because we're pretty afraid and confused as when we look forward to the next 50, 100 years. We really need religion. And religion really can't afford to be, my team versus your team. This is the truth and that's wrong. We really can't afford that anymore. This is no longer tenable. So we really need to re-understand, like, what is religion for? Why does it exist? I mean, there was a time, you know, maybe 100 years ago or so, when people thought, oh, finally we're over religion. And now we have science. And now we understand the world rationally. We don't need religion anymore. And that's really been the way people have looked at it up until recently. So if we do still need religion, we can't have it in the old way. We have, not that the old traditions are not valuable. We all here in the room know how valuable Buddhism is and how valuable these teachings are. So we know that. It's not that we're throwing that out. It's just that we have to hold it in a different way. And that's what a lot of the scholarship is going toward, re-envisioning and re-contextualizing religious life. So, yeah, unfortunately, nobody reads the scholarship. So, like, it's not unusual for a scholar to spend a life, literally a life's work, writing one or two books. And those one or two books will be read by a few hundred people. And they're published by obscure university presses, and they cost $85 for the hardback book because nobody buys them, so they have to, and libraries buy them, and libraries will pay that, you know. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Oh, how wonderful.
About 15 years ago?
Oh, I must have been there.
You were there.
Yeah. How do you like that? Was I leading the practice period?
You were not there.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah. And part of the reason that I went, besides the fact that all my stuff had just got stolen, and I thought that non-attachment was a good thing to learn.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You mean cynical on that point or on life in general?
Well, I'm English, so, you know, it's in general. But, no, on that
point. That's an explanation for your English, therefore.
But it was really important to me, actually, that.
What did they tell you in response to your question?
Anymore, and I'm just wondering if it's something that happened without people talking
Well, you know, I'm not at all sure that anything did happen. And it sounds like that from what you're saying, I'm getting the feeling that you might be misunderstanding me when I use the word religion or faith. It sounds like you think that, and it's understandable that you would, because from the point of view of Western culture and the way that we've been used to looking at things, if you say faith, what that means is, I have faith that the following things are true. I have faith that, you know, Jesus Christ was resurrected, or that when you die, you're reincarnated. I have faith in those things, and that's how I know I'm a Buddhist or a Christian or whatever. That's not what I mean by faith at all. That's not what I mean. I don't mean faith in a set of propositions being true and not false. That's not what I mean by faith. By faith, I mean faith in life. Faith in the practice that we do. Faith in kindness. Faith in a way of life that seems to be efficacious for compassion and loving kindness. And that's the kind of faith that I have cultivated in, and I'm trying to cultivate in my life. Faith that there is a way of life that I can practice, a way that I can live, that really will connect me to others and really will help me to have less suffering and more happiness. That's the kind of faith I'm talking about. And that's irrespective of whether I believe in that reincarnation is true, or Buddha was a deity, or Buddha was this or that, Buddha even lived. That's not the kind of faith I'm talking about. And when I say religion, I'm not, religion, you know, is defined in various ways. There's lots of ways of looking at that. You know, some people say religion is belief in a supreme being. Well, if that's the way you define religion, then Buddhism is not a religion. But to me, religion is, we can look at a group of people and the way they behave together, and then we say, well, if there's clergy, if there's ritual, if there's scriptures, if there's practice, you call it a religion. So in that sense, I'm distinguishing between religion, which really is like a whole way of life and whole culture. Not necessarily a list of things you're supposed to believe, but a way of life, a way of proceeding in life. That versus a technical thing of meditate in the right way and poof, you'll have an experience that will be the goal of your practice. You can meditate in the right way, and you can have experiences, and those experiences can be wonderful and transformative. But the point is not having those experiences. The point is the whole way of life and the whole way of living and looking at life. So that's what I mean.
Do you feel like there is a place for agnostic Buddhists?
Of course. In Buddhism, Buddhism is particularly characterized by the, you know, many people quote the early words of the Buddha, come and see. Not believe the following things and accept the following things and then come. Come and see. But the thing is that this should be true of all religions. It should be true of all religions. Everybody should be welcome to go to a church or a synagogue or a mosque and come and see. And find your way, find your place there. Your place there might be, I want to go every week for the rest of my life. Your place there might be, I enjoy this and I'll come once in a while, I get something out of it. You know, you find your own place. And so this is explicit in Buddhism. But I think it should be the case with all religious traditions. We got to get over this believing this is right and you don't believe this, you're a lesser human being and so on and so forth. So there is a place. So it's not right that you don't have a place. You have a place. Well, the one who's most famous for it is...
He won't talk about it anymore.
Who's that?
Batchelor.
Stephen Batchelor, yeah. Well, he's probably tired of it. Yeah. Typically, I would say that in Tibetan Buddhism, there is more of a sense of needing to believe that that's so. In Zen, Zen is, I think... That is the Zen point of view. It's just what you're saying, it's sort of agnostic. not exactly agnostic. Agnostic is a misnomer because that means neither believing in God nor not. You know, in Zen, the great Zen story about reincarnation is the story of Guishan, who said, "When I die, I'll be reborn as a buffalo on the mountainside, and you'll know that it's me, because you'll see written on the side of the buffalo the characters Guishan." And that's how you'll know it's me. He said, now if you look at that buffalo and you say it's a buffalo, you'll be wrong. On the other hand, if you look at the buffalo and you say it's Guishan, you'll also be wrong. That's the Zen point of view on rebirth. In other words, the point is, and I feel this way personally, myself, I don't say that everybody who passes away from this life will be reborn. I also don't say that there's definitely not that, because I actually don't know. Now, I admire people who actually know this. You know, to me, that's like a great thing, to actually know. Like to have memories of your past life, to know for sure that in the past life you were the Queen of Sheba or something. Like, wow, that's, I'm impressed with that. But I don't have that knowledge. Neither do I know, like, I really don't know what happens after you die. And, like, if somebody here does know, let's talk afterward, because I'm interested, actually. But I don't know. So if someone says that you're reborn, I say, well, I guess that could be. One thing I do know, and I know this not because I have like flashes of memory or something or insight, but because I feel it in my everyday life, in the depth of time that we were talking this morning, you know, in the deja vu-ness of time, in the depth of time, what I know is that this little span of time between the time that I was born, which seems like a really short time ago, you know, even though I'm not that young, it seems like a really short time, and the time that's even shorter from now, when I'll be gone from this form and plant. It seems to me that doesn't entirely explain my life, that span of time. It seems to me that somehow or other, in a way that I don't really understand, there's more to my life than that. And I know that, you know. I actually know that on some level. Don't ask me to explain, but it's something I feel that I know. And that seems important to me, to the religious life, to understand that. Seems important to really have the incentive to practice. And in other words, if I want to be kind and live a life that is of benefit to others, it's a bigger question than just this span of time. There's something more to it than that. And I do feel that as a reality. So whether you call that rebirth or what you call it, I don't know. And maybe it's something about the nature of time and the nature of, you know, what it means to be alive in a moment of time. But to me that is important, and that is important in the religious life. Now, I don't say that in order to practice, to go to a meditation retreat or continue to practice Buddhism, you have to feel that way. I think maybe you will feel that way if you practice for a long time. But if you don't, even if you don't feel that way, you think, what's he talking about? He's nuts. Doesn't make any difference. You still can practice. I think nobody's here without faith, right? You're not here without faith. Obviously, you have enough faith to think that it's worth your while to spend a weekend hanging around doing nothing together. You think, you know, you have that much faith to think that this weekend of my life is worth spending in this way. And if you come back again, you have enough faith to feel like this is really important for me. This really matters to me somehow. Well, that's faith, isn't it? Isn't that faith? Yeah. And so as you continue, I think that kind of faith increases. And you know what? In a confusing world with a lot of troubles, it is no small thing to feel, yeah, I have something that I have faith in. I have a practice that I can go to, and I can really trust and enjoy being with people who share that sense of life. And that really supports me in tough times and in not tough times to keep me going. That's not a small thing. And that's why we need religion, I believe. We really need that. So.
I was thinking over the lunch hour about the story that you told, the tailor, and the accessibility of awakening. And I experienced, in reflecting on it, some tension between that idea and the choices that we make in our day-to-day lives, in the following sense. We all make choices about relationships, work, place where we live visibly in the world. If, and I do believe it to be true, that the possibility of awakening is there with us at every moment, if that's the case, how do we know when we're making a decision that's just another sort of errand, right, or detour, or sort of running away from that immediacy, that accessibility? How do we distinguish between making a decision that way and making a decision that, I guess, it's more authentic? Does that make sense?
Oh, completely. Did everybody hear that? And that is the question, right? That's the problem, and that's the question. That's our life. That's exactly the edge that we're always having to live. And, you know, in a way, the answer to that question is really comes down to the experience and sensibility of a lifetime. In other words, there isn't like, oh, here's the answer to that question. You know, it's not that simple. But there is, first of all, there is the need to have the question. And not everybody has that question. And we all need to have it, but not everybody has it. So it's kind of like every morning we wake up in the morning, and you know, we're in a, at home, we're in a practice period, and I give everybody this practice, which I've been doing myself, and I offer it to you too. It's a beautiful practice. See if you can, when you wake up in the morning and get out of bed, the first thing, when your feet touch the floor, getting out of bed, if you could remember to have the thought in your mind, this is a day of my life. This is a day of spiritual practice. What will I do with this day? This is an important day, an unrepeatable day in my life. Some, you know, in other words, remember your spiritual practice. So you just don't bumble out of bed and, you know, go along unconsciously living that day of your life. And that's the answer to the question, in a sense. In other words, the answer to the question is that we cultivate a way of life in which every single day we are concerned with that question, and we are investigating that question, and we're asking ourselves that question. And we're letting our decisions and activities all day long be inspired by that question. And when we do that, and keep that as a question, and we keep our eyes open, we learn. We find out, oh, that wasn't what I want to be doing. What I did today, what I said, how I've chosen to live today, that isn't right. That's not what I want. That's not in accord with what my deepest intention is. It really isn't. I can feel it. The way that I live today, yes, that's the way. And like that, keeping that question and keeping going with our practice and our living, we learn. You know, I now know in myself, you know, I can see it coming a mile away. Whoa, there comes that whole train of thought, you know. Whoa, never mind. I don't need that. That's not what I want. That's not the way I want to live. I don't want to entertain all that. I know that. So that's how we practice. So, and that's where, you know, all this stuff that I'm calling, you know, the religious life comes into it. Because that's not just, I mean, to do that just on your own without meditation practice, without some community, without teachings, without reflections, without, you know, cultivating many practices, it won't work, because the world is so much, the world is very persuasive, you know. I mean, look at how persuaded we all are by the shopping malls and the mortgages and all this stuff. It's very persuasive. Let's not kid ourselves. This is very important stuff that has a tremendous power and always has in human life. So we need a lot of help. if we're going to really live a life with depth, a religious life, or whatever you want to call it, a spiritual life, an ethical life, we really need to put some effort into that. We really need to realize that's important. And that's why we come to meditation, why we come on Tuesday nights to Sims, why we study sutras, why we listen to talks online, and so on and so forth, so that we can keep that reflection going in our lives. And then our life is the answer to the question. In the end, you know, we hope that when we're, you know, lying on our deathbed, you know, we can say, yeah, my life was the answer to the question of my life. It really was. I answered the question of my life, and now I'm ready to let it go. Wouldn't that be a good way? And it's lousy to sort of say, oh, my God, you know, it's too late now. And I didn't engage the question of my life. I just didn't. I frittered my time away. Damn it. Too late now. But no problem. I'll be reborn. as a what?
As a buffalo.
Yeah, right. And I'll work it out then, so I don't need to worry about it. Yes?
I keep thinking about this story also of the pot of gold. And if, you know, thinking that if the tailor had heard the story of the Buddha, he would have realized immediately that the pot of gold was buried under the stove, dug it up, and never left home. You know, it's like if you're in a relationship and you're looking for, you know, you it's lost, it's a little whatever else, and suddenly the dream is somewhere else. You know,
yeah.
1,000, 2,000 miles.
Yeah, away. Yeah, yeah.
You know, how do you, is the process, is it, you know, to come to that you are present to the pot of gold and it's not somewhere else, and once you go on the journey, then you're going to realize,
yeah,
that you left the pot of gold. I'm very much in a situation like that right now in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And in the sense, I'm using the idea of a journey in the broadest sense, because you could say, so if the tailor had met the Buddha on his way to the capital city, he runs into the Buddha, you know, and the Buddha says, oh, you don't need to go to the capital, forget about the treasures at your house, just go home and meditate. And he goes home and he meditates and eventually finds a treasure. Well, that would have been his journey. Would have been still a journey. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, if there weren't a journey necessary, then there wouldn't be religion. We wouldn't have the human problems, right? We would automatically, everything would be fine. But we seem to have human problems, which requires some journey toward returning to ourselves and overcoming our problems. Now, saying that our awakening is always buried underneath the stove in our own house, I'm not saying that there aren't times in life when you change your situation. So, of course, you know, we leave jobs, we leave relationships, we leave one country and move to another one or whatever, when that's what we have to do. So it's not that there's a kind of blanket rule. Well, you were born in Detroit, you stay in Detroit. What are you doing here in Seattle? You know, you should be back in Detroit. That's not what I'm saying. It's a matter of the heart. So whatever your issue that you're chewing on now, I don't know what you should do, you know, and it's not, and I think that nothing that I'm saying is a slam dunk answer to the question. But the answer is in you. So you know what. So sometimes the answer is, yeah, I do have to change my circumstances. And sometimes the answer is, no, I really need to stay right where I am in this situation in order to clarify what's going on here. But chasing after, you know, a dream, circumstances are never going to be perfect. We know that, right? Inner and outer circumstances. And creating the right circumstances, whether they're inner circumstances or outer circumstances, is never the answer to our problems. We can improve, we can adjust, that's fine, as long as we are not lusting after some other situation. So, and I always felt like myself, this has nothing to do with anything other than a personal commitment or a personal practice that I've always done, and that is that when the time does come for me to change my situation, if I know that that's true, I always make sure that when I'm changing the situation, I have come to peace with the situation that I'm about to change. In other words, when I catch myself thinking, oh, this really sucks and I got to get out of here and things are going to be a lot better once I get rid of this. Whenever I find myself thinking that way, I know that I'm confused. And I keep coming back to the present moment and keep coming back to my body and my breath until I get to the place where I understand this is the place or the situation that had to be in my life at this time. It was really right, and I really appreciate all of its dimensions, even the painful ones. And appreciating that, I'm now moving on. So that's, I think that's good advice, and that's what the way I've always tried to practice. And when I move on, there'll be new problems.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be new. It won't be the same exactly the satisfactions, but there'll be new ones. So, and that's how we grow. I think is through working through all those things in our life. In the meantime, if you do walking meditation outside, as we were a little while ago, and the sun is shining on you, isn't that wonderful? Is that great or what? You know? Yeah. Yeah, and if you look around and you see, a beautiful building that someone built, you really think this is really great. So what I mean to say is that if you can slow down for your life, even if you have many big problems, that bird that we started our conversation with, that bird that we see and really, really see, that illuminates our life. And there's real joy. So even if we're in the midst of some problem or something we have to change or do or reflect on, in any moment of time, we can drop down to gratitude and joy, because it's amazing that we're alive and that we have a body that can feel the warmth of the sun and that we have ears that can hear the song of a bird. So we always, our practice helps us to really be there for those moments. And there can be hundreds of them every day, hundreds, every single day. What else? Yes?
I'd like to kind of follow up on the last couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
I love listening to you because you seem to me to be someone who's very prolific with his creativity or his personal or charitable expression. And the biggest tension that I seem to feel in my life is just having a plan that I would like to be charitable with something I can create. For instance, I take a lot of photographs and how to share them, that kind of thing. And then the time, the energy that I have, the other commitments, and then the pressure comes in. I'm not sticking with this a plan because I'm dealing with the laundry or working out an extra day of work or something like that. So, do you face any kind of tension? And if you do, how do you look at that about the plans that you have for your expression and sharing?
Well, everybody's really busy these days, don't you think? Anybody here who's not that busy? You? Great. Do you are you unemployed? Are you unemployed?
No, but I'm self-employed, and it's very lonely because I'm cultivating more and more people.
Uh-huh. Yeah, isn't it?
Even if people are unemployed, they're busy. They're busy being unemployed.
Yeah. 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 So you really feel that your life is slowing down for you. Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. How do you do it?
Do a lot of sitting. Because of self-employed, I turned down jobs so I could go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Mexico and spent 10 days doing nothing in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually better than any retreat I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to the sounds of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
And my clock changed and I came back and everybody in my life wanted to try and get together in 3 months.
Yeah, right. So you maybe simplified your life so you don't need as much income? You can afford to turn down jobs? Or
it's more that my sense of my life is that it's not focused around feeling slow.
Uh-huh. That's your priority. Yeah. Now, do you have a family?
I don't have kids. I don't have a lot of normal distractions that people have in family life.
Uh-huh.
So I can't control my life.
Yeah.
Doesn't
mean
that I don't often feel like I have too much to do, but I know that my baseline is surrounded with
Well, in a way, what you're saying is a good response to your question, because what you're saying is that you made a priority. Whatever, I mean, your priority is, I'm not going to be crazy busy, and so that's the main thing. So you made a priority, and you tried to live all the time keeping that priority in mind and not letting other things get the best of you.
I also completely empathize with his question, because I have two careers, I'm a fine artist and a commercial artist.
Mm-hmm.
It can be very, very challenging to do those things and keep the art in the house.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moving target if you're focused.
Mm-hmm. But I think the idea that one has a priority. And it could be shifting, you know. In other words, I do that. I have shifting priorities. Something is a priority, but now something else is lacking over here, so now that priority has to come to the top. So if you for many years have wanted to share your creativity and haven't done it, it must be because it's a lower priority for you than other things. So you have to intentionally, at least for a while, put that priority on top of your pile of priorities. And that might mean that other things will suffer, but they will have to suffer temporarily while something else is a priority. So I suppose there's a certain amount of discipline involved in that, and also a certain amount of knowing yourself. Because sometimes we have priorities that we purposely don't put on the top of our pile so that we can continue to complain to ourselves, about ourselves. Sometimes we actually want to do that, and we don't know that. And that's why we never put that priority on the top. So we have to know ourselves well enough to know if there's anything like that going on, and if there is, to say, well, I'm not going to let that continue to get the best of me. So the next thing I'm going to do is focus on this exhibition of my photographs that I'm going to have at my house. And so the first thing I'm going to do is schedule that and send an email to my 30 best friends. I don't have the photographs taken yet. I haven't framed them yet. But it's on my calendar and they'll be coming over. So now I really have to do something about that, because it's going to be really embarrassing if they all show up and there's no photographs there, because I told them that I'm going to do this. So in that way, you can do that. So it'll be on the Sims website, I guess. And also the website of the Zen group, the Rinzai Zen group in town, that you will be having a party at your house where you'll be showing your photographs and people will be coming. And so, yeah, there's going to be a lot of dirty laundry, you know, until after the event. Are you going to do it? I'm just asking.
Oh, yeah.
Good. All right. If I'm in town, I'll come. Send me an email. Yeah. Really? Are you really going to do it?
I mean,
I'm incredulous that you're really going to do this. Are you?
Sure.
He's doing this. Wow.
I think that's a big change in my question really was at heart was there's like an awareness of the almost visceral anxiety about moving. And
moving, you mean doing something?
Yeah. I feel it every day. I feel it sometimes when I wake up in the morning. Even when I'm putting my feet on the floor, there's like, oh.
Yeah.
And that is a most amazing, subtle awareness. And that is that's what I was wondering if.
Yeah.
You,
well, it's wonderful. Yeah. Well, it's wonderful that feeling, which I think so many of us feel, but are not aware of, has come to your attention in that raw and stark way. And so, just like you say, I think that you need to investigate. What is the source of this pain? You need to investigate that on your cushion. You need to go to retreats and investigate it. You need to investigate it through all the days of your life until you really understand where it comes from and what its source is. And I think when you understand, then there'll be some relief. And I think you'll find that a lot of what you do is turn away from it, even as you're feeling it. You know, you really don't want it to be there. So what you have to do is really let it be there and really be right up with it and really accept it and investigate it and study the subtle ways in which you turn away from it. So that's the ultimate koan, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. That makes all those funny Zen stories seem trivial by comparison, doesn't it? Yeah, because a lot of them are trying to evoke that. For you, now it's a visceral feeling. You don't need the words anymore. You don't need the stories. Yeah, it's right there. That's right. It's right there. Yeah, so please practice with it. Wonderful. But anyway, still you should do the photography show. So why do you feel numb? Why is that?
It's been an adaptation to a stressful life to not feel. And I want to unlock that part of me.
Yeah.
It's not an accurate way to live.
Yeah.
I need to unlock it if you don't feel anything.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a practical way of living, not just...
Yeah. So have you... Yeah, so you've been practicing meditation for a while?
Yeah, a little bit, for about a year.
Have you gone to long retreats?
I've been to a metta retreat for 5 days, and my heart opened up in the fourth day, and then I went to a forgiveness practice, and I ended up right up again.
And this numbness and strategy that you've been having to live has been long-standing in your life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Become so much of a habit.
Yeah, right.
And do the habit.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I think it's wonderful that you have the clarity, you know, that you understand, you know, what it is you're up against and what you're trying to do. And the practice will help you. And maybe already is helping you. And it does take time. That's the thing. It isn't like, just do this, you know, and everything will be fine tomorrow. It'll take time, and the reason I asked about long retreats is because I think that doing sesshins or long retreats really does help. Because we were talking before about, you know, conscious mind. What we do is we have whole conscious ideologies and strategies that we set up to defend ourselves against something that's unconscious and deep within us. And if you sit there long enough, eventually these things erupt into the conscious mind, and things happen in the body and happen in the mind. It's as if we've built up armor over a lifetime, and we've got to just little by little melt that armor. And it takes time, and sometimes there are some pain involved. But with steadiness of practice and continuity of practice, and this is really important, continuity of practice. So even you can't do retreats all the time, but you can do daily sitting in between the retreats. With continuity of practice and real effort and real, you know, and also, I mean, one could also ask for help. You know, like as if praying. You could really, please help me. Please help me. Buddha, please help me. God, please help me. Jesus, please help me. Whoever, please help me to continue to make this effort and help me to release. And if you do that and have that attitude and keep on with it, you will. It will happen. You know, it will take time. And you'll meet people along the way who will help you. It won't just be your heroic, you know, effort. It'll be you're making your best effort, other people helping you, feeling sometimes just the silent support of others, the teachings, all of that together. It will happen. It will happen. And really, you know, just like I was saying to you over there, that, and I'm sorry I don't know your name. You told me your name, but I forgot. Tell me again. You gave me your Daiki, your Dharma name. Anyway, just like with Daiki, knowing the clarity of the problem, even though it feels frustrating, like there it is. It doesn't help that I know it, but it does help a lot. Because the danger is denial. And that's the real pain, you know. Not to face the pain is the real pain. And so you're miles ahead knowing that. And, you know, Buddha will help you. And you'll find some peace and that will happen. So, and I really wish you the best with that.
Well, can you say one of the barriers I found is I'm switching to teaching, I'm mostly unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
So then I see the retreats, and sometimes there are scholarships here. You might be able to go to the men's retreat because that was a scholarship day.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was lucky about here, usually on an indirect scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can always ask, and often there are ways of, even if it doesn't say there's a scholarship, sometimes if you explain your circumstances. And then usually when you practice in a community and are known within that community, people find ways to help you. So, yeah, it'll work out. Thanks for being willing to say that to us all. I appreciate it. Well, yes?
I really feel that the concept of the metaphor is a wonderful gift, because sometimes when it just seems so abstract, to just think of the Odyssey or something like that, to just, it reminds me that I may not really know how I'm working toward it right now, but
mm-hmm.
I'm on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you, yeah. Yeah, I know that the I think Buddhism in particular lends itself over much to the fiction that religious life is a scientific matter. It works like this. First you do this, and then you do that, and then do this, and do that, and do this. And if you follow my instructions, this is what's going to happen. Buddhism sort of lends itself to that viewpoint. And I appreciate Buddhism for giving us instructions, you know, in that way, and giving us such a clear practice. Sit and breathe. It's wonderful, you know. But in the end, it isn't so. It's like so scientific, you know. Just like, you know, we're not, you know, I mean, I love it. I have a nephew who's a cognitive scientist and studies the brain, and there's all these studies of the brain now and so on and so forth, as if they were like figuring out what makes us tick, and they're almost there. They almost got it worked out. Not really, no. and anybody who is a cognitive scientist like my nephew, who's thought about this for more than 5 minutes, says, you know, the amount we know about how the brain works and how human beings function is this much. And we haven't even like gotten the tools to begin to even think about the first thing, let alone all of it. So it's more complicated than a machine. We're not machines. And so that's why it does help to realize, okay, that's why trust and faith are so important. And again, not faith that there's reincarnation, etc., but faith that as a human being, if I go forward with my religious life, I'll find peace. I'll find what I'm looking for, even if I'm not sure what it is. And I'm going to make effort, and I'm not sure what I'm doing, but if I go ahead, I'll find it. And that's the comfort that metaphor gives us. Yeah. Well, so much for my plan for the day. But that's good, because my plan wasn't that great anyway. In fact, I was having trouble really thinking of a plan, actually. But let me just end with reading another section of the book to kind of give you something to think about between now and the time we meet again tomorrow. And is everybody okay with time? We took a longer lunch break. What time were we supposed to end? At 4? 4:30. Oh, okay. So we'll end by 4:30. This is the first chapter. What I was reading from this morning was the introduction. So this is the first chapter, and the title of it is The Sea of Stories. And it's sort of a good segue from what you just said about metaphor. Our lives are full of stories. We're inundated by stories. Think about it. You get up in the morning and you turn on the radio and you hear the story of the world's morning news. During the day, you hear stories from your friends, your family members, your co-workers, your acquaintances. You put on a CD or the radio again and you hear popular songs. Listen to the lyrics. They're telling stories. You go to the movies. Go on the internet. Read the newspapers. Almost all of our institutions, from business to psychotherapy, from the school to the pulpit, organize their messages through story. And then we go to sleep at night, read ourselves to sleep with a magazine or a book or maybe watch television, and we dream stories. You'd think that we would be tired of stories. There's so many stories every day. You'd think that we would have heard it all by now. But our appetite for stories is unabated. Creating, processing, and interpreting stories is a key industry on this planet. And right now, while we're sitting here, there are probably hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, at this very moment, working on creating new stories that we will consume, discuss, fret about, dote on, forget, and remember. We have a human obsession with stories. And stories are as old as language. Before the printing press, even before writing, people told stories. They told them in verse. They sang them. They blurted them out during working or walking. They whispered them to one another at night. They declaimed them from the holy places. People remembered and invented stories, sacred stories, profane stories, jokes, parables, fairy tales. When we were all children, we were fascinated with the stories that we heard before going to bed. Could you read it again? Could you read it again? One more time? Would you read it again? We said, or maybe our children say. And now we have more stories than ever, because now we have stories from other cultures and other worlds and other times. We nowadays have more stories floating around in our world than ever before in the history of the planet. And stories, if you listen to them, you can really begin to notice patterns. Maybe there are only a few stories. I don't know how many stories there are. But only a certain number of them. And you could, figure out, if you wanted to spend time doing it, what are the 50 top plots and all the variations on them. There was a Russian folklorist named Vladimir Prop who went around the countryside in Russia and Eastern Europe about a century ago and did this. He collected folk stories and legends and fairy tales and discovered the basic structures of them and the predictable variations. But instead of this making the stories more boring or more expected, they seem to add to the interest. It's as if experiencing these deep structures of these stories over and over again gives us a kind of comfort and satisfaction. So we don't mind it. Even if we've heard this story before in some slightly different format, we're eager to hear it again. The next politician who has an extramarital affair, there'll be tremendous interest in this. Everybody will want to hear all the details of it, even though we've heard it how many times before. Because we're like children, Read it again. Read it again, please. It's so reassuring to know that these stories get repeated over and over and over again. To know that the story has a beginning and an ending and a satisfying and predictable order. Stories reflect our hopes, our fears, our dreams. Just the same way that we seem to be fascinated with looking at ourselves in the mirror, though we are reasonably sure of what we will see. And yet, tomorrow we will all look at ourselves in the mirror with kind of interest. We never tire of stories either, no matter how repetitive they may be. Because through the stories, we see ourselves in a kind of experimental way, without consequences. In stories, we share the human drama, of which our own life is but a small, reflective sliver. But, also, and we know this too, what a distraction stories are. Immersed in the latest soap opera on television, or the newspaper, or the internet, or in the lives of our friends, or our own lives, we avoid very often something we need to be tending to, we need to be looking at that's real in our own experience. We avoid the challenge and the truth in our own lives. We avoid the real joys and horrors of the world by distracting ourselves with stories. And as I'm sure everyone here knows, this is something that was of concern to the Buddha. The Buddha noticed with compelling acuity the way that our absorption in stories, even our own personal stories, maybe especially our own personal stories, could, and so often did, function as an avoidance mechanism with disastrous effects. Immersed in the passion of the tale, we forget who and what we really are about, and we don't pay attention to the deeper structures of our thought and behavior, and we go on suffering driven and unexamined lives, hurting ourselves and others in the process. So the Buddha noticed this, and that's why he wanted to talk about non-self or no self. By which he meant not that there is no experience of subjectivity, but that the self that we're obsessed with in the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves, the self of gossip and myth, the self of our own repeating emotional tape loops, is not a true self, and it's not a useful self. It's not a self that leads us to liberation. Every story, when it hooks us onto its plot line and shapes us through its narrative structure, says way too much that is not true and way too little that is true. And that's why the Buddha, as an antidote to this human obsession with stories, taught, moment by moment, attention to the elements of perceptual, emotional, and intellectual experience. That's what mindfulness is. It's moment by moment attention to the details of our experience, apart from the story. And the Buddha once said, in the seen, let there be only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. And this is kind of like what we were saying before about early Zen. You know, this is kind of like, that's where it comes from in early Buddhism. In other words, let go of the story and pay attention to the actual moment-by-moment facts of your life. And when you do that, the Buddha felt, without being swept away by your exciting plot lines, you will be able to notice. And again, this speaks to what you were saying. You will begin to gradually notice what kinds of decisions and what kinds of things that you do that cause suffering and trouble, and what kinds of things that you think and do will lead you to happiness and wisdom. And when you see this clearly, you will choose what's wise and happy-making over what makes you suffer and causes more confusion. And your life will change and improve, and your friends will be happier to know you. Now, I've been following the Buddha's teaching for my whole life, and so I've tried to practice in this way, not to be that concerned, or as much concerned as I might have been before, about my own story, and being more concerned and more aware of fleeting moments that come and go with a tremendous fullness of emotion and perception, and being less subject to the heights and depths of my own story, and more aware and tolerant of the patterns of my thinking and feeling, I think I'm a lot happier person than I was before. I think it actually has helped my life a lot to practice the Buddha's way of awareness. But you just can't get around stories. You know? To come to the conclusion that therefore we should eliminate stories and not indulge in them at all would be to eliminate, you know, what it is that human beings have always done. Because in a way, you could say, to be human is to tell your story. And to be human is to listen to someone else's story. But it would make a difference if you knew that your story is a story. You know, you have a story of your life. Your spouse has a story of your life. Your parents have a story of your life. Your children have a story of your life. Your co-workers have a story of you. And all those stories are different. But everybody who holds one of those stories of your life is pretty sure that's the story, right? And therein lies a problem. We don't really know that the stories that we hold are stories. So it would make a big difference to know that. I don't say that, you know, the stories are all illusions or have no reality to them. But they're stories. They're real stories, not absolute truths. And when we understand them that way, we don't have to be quite as mesmerized by them as we were before. To know that my story is not exactly true entirely, and it's not exactly mine either. My story, and your story too, is like a wave rising up within the sea of stories. Now, this vast sea of stories that is going on, washing over our lives all day long, every day, year after year. Each one of our stories is a sea, a wave rising up in that sea of stories. And when you understand your story like that and feel it like that, you appreciate your story a whole lot more. You appreciate what's happened to you in your life in a different way, in a wider and more significant way. Maybe when we look at our stories this way, we can appreciate how big they are and how mysterious they are. Then maybe we won't be clinging anymore to the particular version of our story that we think is the only true version. The version that says that we're victims. The version that says that our lives are trivial. The version that says that our lives are boring or full of despair. Instead, we might begin to see that we have many stories. And that all the stories are stories of our humanness. Stories of our being aliveness, not just our small possessions that make us feel pain. And then, maybe our very stories will energize us forward into a new life. So, I'd like to conclude by having us stand up for just a minute or two of stretching and then a short sit and a guided meditation about this.